A popular novel, a bestseller, was recently ordered banned by the police of two metropolitan cities for the same reason. And considerable controversy followed these two actions. Cries of censorship were raised, and men rushed in to defend the rights and the freedoms of authors and artists, and to warn against thought control . I, for one, do not know why a cardinal, or for that matter, any minister of religion, or any layman, or anyone whose opinions may influence public opinion, should not have the right to denounce a picture or a book which he regards as lewd and vicious and corruptive. And I, for one, do not know why good acting or artistic writing should necessarily condone indecent subject matter. I do not wish at this moment to enter into the question of censorship. It is a very involved question and not at all one-sided. It has its uses and it has its patent dangers. And one cannot be dogmatic about it at all. But this I know, and anyone who has followed cultural trends in American life must know, that there has been a growing coarsening and vulgarization and sexualization in our novels, plays, magazines, movies, television, and the press, which no amount of eloquent talk about the freedom of writers and artists and entertainers can cover up or explain away. Now, people may differ as to the causes of these phenomena. People may differ as to their possible cure. But there can be no difference in my mind as to the facts. And the facts are very disturbing indeed. I recently received a book from Professor Peterim Sorokin of Harvard called The American Sex Revolution. Professor Sorokin, you may recall, was for many years professor and chairman of the sociology department at Harvard, and is today the director of the Harvard Research Center in Creative Altruism. He's the author of numerous and important scientific studies in the fields of social sciences and human behavior. Professor Sorokin is greatly disturbed over what he calls this growing sex laxity of sex freedom of our day. He is persuaded that Americans are drifting towards sex anarchy. We are completely surrounded, he maintains, by a rising tide of sex which is flooding every compartment of our culture, every section of our social life. The nation's sex obsession is reflected in the mounting divorce rates, the upsurge in sex crimes, in the emphasis which is placed upon sex in radio and television programs, in stage plays, movies, in popular songs, pictures, reading matter, advertising, and in the wild jungle music of our day. We are living through the descent, he maintains, of an art forms into social sewers. Rock and roll is not merely the fantasy of crazy teenagers, but a symptom of a decaying art form in America. He sees a disastrous revolution and the sex behavior of our people, which is radically changing the lives of men and women. Now, Professor Sorokin's study is carefully documented. He writes as a scientist, not as a puritanic crusader. He records facts. And on the basis of historic precedents, he points to what these facts will inevitably lead to. How they will affect the lives, how they do affect the lives of individuals and of a community and the future of society generally. The professor first draws attention to the status of marriage, the family, in our day. The institution of marriage and the integrity of home and family have been severely shaken by this sex revolution of our day. And the startling increase in divorces is an indication of it. In 1870, states the professor, there was one divorce for every 40 marriages contracted. In the last few years, one divorce for every 3 marriages. And as a result of the mounting number of divorces and separations and desertions, about 12 million out of the 45 million children in the United States do not live with both parents and are forcibly exposed to all the inclemencies of the half-parental or non-parental homes or of no homes at all. And a large proportion of divorces and desertions are the direct result of adultery or other forms of illicit sex adventures committed by one or both parties. Increasing divorce and desertion and the growth of prenuptial and extramarital sex relations are signs of sex addiction somewhat similar to drug addiction, the professor maintains. And this sex addiction has invaded other departments of American life besides the home and the family. Take our recent literature. books, novels, plays. In its topics and personages and scenes and aims, our literature is largely centered in sex, especially in its pathological forms. And a good deal of it borders on the pornographic. Large-scale manufacture and commercial exploitation of these sex-saturated books would not be possible if they did not appeal to the common literary tastes of millions. And whatever we like it or not, says the professor, the obsession with sex in our literature is an ugly fact beyond any reasonable doubt. Very often, even a good book is somehow made to drag in sex scenes, not because they help to develop the plot of the story or are necessary to the development of character, but simply to increase the sale of the book. The pornographic pulp literature, maintains the professor, has a reading public far in excess of fine, serious literature. And he states, this pulp stuff is poured onto the market in hundreds of thousands of copies of dime and quarter novels, in millions of copies of various magazines, in many millions of erotic comics and periodical stories. The sadistic novels of Mickey Spillane have sold more than 25 million copies. And the total output of this sort of stuff is to be counted in the hundreds of millions. In addition, some of this material is turned into popular movies, is brought into millions of homes by radio and television, and is even dramatized on a legitimate stage. All in all, this stuff has become omnipresent in our lives, and every one of us is incessantly and increasingly exposed to its radiations. This sexualization of American culture is manifest also in the popular music of our day. The bleating of the crooners of our popular songs is underscored by their gyrations and their contortions and their bodily rhythms, all too clear in sexual innuendo. And the records of this type of music are sold by the millions. The records of a recent, especially epileptic kind of a crooner has accounted for more than 65% of all the records sold by the most important record-making organization in our country. Our popular entertainment, according to Professor Sorokin, is likewise sex-obsessed. A study in 1930 disclosed that about 45% of the topics of our movies was devoted to sex, and about 28% more to crime, frequently associated with sex. And since that time, the trend has been in the direction of increase rather than of decrease. You take up a newspaper, any newspaper in any city of the United States, and look upon the advertising page which announces our movies and our entertainments. And they look, the columns, the page look either like some shooting gallery with guns and pistols popping all over, or like a sailor's tattoo on his arms. This is true also of television. Professor Sorokin makes sharp strictures about our television. I'm not entirely in agreement with his thoroughgoing indictment, but there is considerable truth when he says that so far, almost the only important achievement of this new instrument of communication has consisted in bringing into millions of our homes the erotically charged, alcoholic atmosphere of nightclubs, ugly commercials, and endless murder and sex plays. Television has also brought into our homes some magnificent things. Educational, as well as entertainment. But I think there is considerable truth in what the professor says. Take these Western pictures, which are especially directed towards our juveniles, towards our children. So full of violence, so much of shooting, killing, gouging, fighting, beating. Every day, a young boy, a girl watching these Westerners is treated to a half hour or an hour of unleashed violence. And the fact that at the end the thing is sweetened up by the fact that virtue is triumphant does not at all palliate this very serious and, in my judgment, very dangerous period of wrong education that is given to the youth of America. Our serious drama, with some notable exceptions, likewise tends to the erotic and the pathological, while the popular shows fairly exude sex appeal. And Professor Sorokin turns his attention to the American press and newspapers. They have not escaped the vulgarization. The front pages of our newspapers regularly contain spicy stories about sensational crimes, scandal, divorce, the sex adventure of notorious playboys and playgirls, the love affairs of heiresses and entertainment stars, and other such stuff, vividly reported and still more vividly illustrated. Yesterday, our newspapers carried front page stories of an actress returning to the United States, an actress who was taken in adultery, who had a child with her Italian film director while she was still a married woman with a husband back home. Now, the difficulty there is that while we have been admonished, and I suppose properly admonished, not to cast the first stone, we were not admonished to throw orchids at such people. And yet this returning actress is being acclaimed by masses of people and is being given lead stories on the front pages of our newspapers like a conquering hero returning home. The covers of our popular magazines regularly treat us to pictures of seductive females, suggestively radiating sex by posture and facial expression. And this is true also of advertising, maintains the professor. Sex appeal has become a must in commercial advertising of all sorts, whether you advertise cosmetics or automobiles. And he sums up his indictment, if such it be called, in this way. Thus, whatever aspect of our culture is considered, each is packed with sex obsession. Its vast totality bombards us continuously, from cradle to grave, from all points of our living space, at almost every step of our activity, feeling, and thinking. If we escape from being stirred by obscene literature, we may be aroused by the crooners, or by the new psychology and sociology, or by the teachings of the Freudianized pseudo-religions, or by radio-television entertainment. We are completely surrounded by the rising tide of sex, which is flooding every compartment of our culture, every section of our social life. And unless we develop an inner immunity against these libidinal forces, we are bound to be conquered by the continuous pressure of a gigantic army of omnipresent sex stimuli. The professor then proceeds to call attention to the consequences of such moral decadence, consequences for the individual and for society. He maintains that adrift toward sex anarchy has everywhere been matched by a steady increase in mental disturbances. In the United States, our population has doubled since 1880. And during the same period, the number of patients in our mental hospitals has increased 12 times. There are about 650,000 patients in mental hospitals today, comprising some 47% of all hospital patients in the United States. Now, the author does not contend that sex laxity is the only cause of mental illness. Far from it. He maintains, however, that there is a causal relationship between the increase in sex freedom in our day and the increase of cases of neuroses and psychosis. The destructive consequences of sexual anarchy go deep into the vitals of a society. They degrade the value of manhood and of womanhood, of motherhood and of fatherhood, of childhood and of venerable age, of marriage and family, and even of love itself. They contribute to the decline of cultural creativity in an age. It brings an interesting example from Russia. Russia, which in the early stages of the revolution experimented with free love and sexual freedom. During the first stage of the revolution, its leaders deliberately attempted to destroy marriage and the family. Free love was glorified. One could marry and divorce as many times as desired. Husband and wife could obtain a divorce without the other being notified. It was not even necessary that marriages be registered. Bigamy and even polygamy were permissible under the new provisions. And premarital relations were praised, and extramarital relations were considered normal. But within a few years, hordes of wild, homeless children became a real menace to the Soviet Union itself. Millions of lives, especially of young girls, were wrecked. Divorces skyrocketed. the hatreds and conflicts among polygamous and polyandrous mates rapidly mounted, and so did psychoneuroses, and work in the nationalized factories slackened. And the total results were so appalling that the government was forced to reverse its policy. Free love was declared to be counter-revolutionary, and its place was taken by official glorification of premarital chastity and of the sanctity of marriage. And the liberty of divorce was radically curtailed. By the decree of July 14, 1944, it was made impossible for the vast majority of citizens. By now, the cycle has been completed, and a slight relaxation of this too severe expression, repression of sex, is making it moderately normal. Soviet Russia today, as a more monogamic, stable, and Victorian family and marriage life than do most of the Western countries. It's very disturbing to read this book. In places, quite frightening. What is the cure? Well, the professor is not merely interested in stating facts or in indicting conditions, but in pointing the way to amelioration and improvement, sanity. What is the cure for this sex obsession, which has contributed so much to adult criminality and juvenile delinquency, and mental disease? He doesn't rely much upon legal enactments, upon censorships. He dwells very little upon that. But he does make his appeal to the heart and the mind and the spirit of the average man and woman. He calls for an effort to ennoble our cultural life, for a desexualization of our culture. His appeal is directly to the individual, and it speaks words as wise as have been written on the subject. If the ordinary citizen refuses to buy and read the contaminating publications, to attend erotic shows and plays and movies, to vote for libertine politicians, to listen to sexy music, he can greatly contribute to the task of desexualizing the whole cultural and social life of our nation. If one is a businessman, he can undercut many roots of sexual poison ivy by refusing to participate in business enterprises which commercially exploit sexual dregs, by not sponsoring unsuitable programs of radio, television, movies, or press entertainment, by contributing nothing to all the causes, persons, and institutions which breed and propagate the sexual borders. If a person is graced by a spark of creativity, he can tangibly ennoble the socio-cultural world by using his talent for creation of real values and by refusing to misuse it for accretion of sham values generally and of sexual muck specifically. If a considerable and ever-increasing part of our women and men follow this path in their thoughts and their words and their deeds, the infection discussed will rapidly diminish until its ugly scales, rashes, and sores disappear from the cultural and social world in which we live. Such is the triple operation of desexualization of ourselves and our culture and our social life. And I maintain that when all is said and done, this is the answer: reformation of the culture of a people must begin with the people themselves. Judaism waged war upon sexual license ever since its inception. Judaism looked upon sex as holy, not to be degraded by any form of coarseness or indecencies. Judaism looked upon the human body as the temple of the soul. Judaism never extolled celibacy or asceticism. It never built monasteries or nunneries. The renunciation of normal sex life was never regarded as a virtue by Judaism. To marry, to build a home, to beget children, the divine commandment, be fruitful and multiply, is the first commandment of the Bible. But Judaism abhorred all forms of animalism, the coarseness and the brutalizing. What the author calls the sexualization of human life. Because man is much more. Man is a mind and a soul and a spirit. He's made in the image of God. Judaism banished the sex motif from religion. A sex motif which you will remember was universal in all the religions of the ancient world. It banished all the orgiastic rites, the institution of sacred prostitution, which were associated with the fertility cults and the nature worship of all the peoples of the ancient world. And the Bible abounds in denunciations of all these obscene practices and outlawed them. Purity of family life, to a degree practically unknown in the ancient world, even among its most advanced circles, purity of family life, Taharat HaMishpacha, became the norm for the Jewish way of life. And it has remained a characteristic of Jewish behavior throughout the ages. It is beginning to give way. Jews sometimes learn from their environment, not the best that's in the environment, but sometimes the worst. Modesty was urged upon men and women by Judaism. The principle was laid down, sanctify yourself even in things permitted to you. New concepts were introduced by our religion. Tzniut, which means modesty, moral delicacy. Boshet, which means moral reticence, sensitiveness to all that is gross. There is nothing more beloved of God than tzniut, said the rabbis. And he who does not possess the quality of busha, of moral reticence, it is certain that his ancestors were not present at Mount Sinai. It is certain that he's not a Jew. Now this code of boshet, of moral cleanliness in act and word and speech and attitude, this reticence, did not result from any prudery on the part of the people of Israel. It was an expression of reverence for life itself and for the dignity of man. It was the aesthetics of morality which Judaism introduced in the ancient world. The beauty of holiness. What is holy should be beautiful. Not brutalized, not cheapened, not vulgarized. 3,000 years of Jewish literature are distinguished by a remarkable freedom from vulgarity and lubricity. Go through Hebrew literature from earliest times to the latest. You will be proud of the moral cleanliness of that literature which reflected the spirit and the attitudes, the basic attitudes towards life and human relationships on the part of our people. The rabbi said it is a man's duty to keep away from unseemliness, from what resembles unseemliness, and from the semblance of a semblance of unseemliness. There is clearly, good friends, a great need for a moral house cleaning on the part of every American. It's not limited to America by any means. We're interested in America because that is our country. There's a great need for house cleaning in Jewish life. We used to set the standards for the world on these matters of basic human relationships. And I find Jews who permit themselves the same coarseness, the same vulgarization in speech, the same inclination to commercialize on these things. I'm very saddened for them and for the standards of our people. The sex revolution, which is clearly indicated for us, is a return to the noble standards of life which our ancestors defined for us, and which, in my humble judgment, have been responsible for our survival along with our faith. For a small people to have come through thousands of years of persecution, of the cruelest forms of discriminations calculated deliberately to undermine and destroy them, forced to live in the filthiest of quarters, reduced to the filthiest and humblest of occupations, for a people to have survived 2,000 years of that sort of world treatment, and to come into the modern age strong, clean, healthy people, is a tribute to basic attitudes towards life, the fundamental moral commitments which kept the family clean and wholesome, which enabled the family to raise children in an atmosphere of nobility, of reverence for human life and for the basic institutions of society. We ought to return to them. Who shall ascend the mountain of the Lord? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart. Purity of heart will dictate your proper relationship to all these situations of which this author so correctly complains. Purity of heart.